Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. Stay ahead of all the big games in the best league in the world, the Premier League. With the latest odds, form guides, expert opinions and more, the fans are the players at Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com, 18 plus, begambleaware.org. T's and C's apply.
Welcome to Upfront with Tony Cascarino and me, Sam Matterface, on TalkSport. This is the show that takes you into the world of the number nine as we find out what it takes to be a top-flight striker.
Cascarino, the little turn, and it comes back to Cascarino! Yes!
We'll discuss their career-defining goals, the experience of playing in France, and the feeling of when the ball hits the back of the net. You're listening to Upfront with Tony Cascarino and me, Sam Matterface, on TalkSport. My guest today started life as a hairdresser, but very quickly was picked up by Gillingham, where he became renowned for being razor sharp in the penalty box. Success with Millwall followed before moves to Aston Villa, Celtic, Chelsea, before a late flourish in France at Marseille and then Nancy. An Irish legend, famous for not really being Irish, it's Tony Cascarino. Hello, how are you?
Hi, you, Sam. How
did you go from being a hairdresser to an international number nine?
Well, I was doing hairdressing. I sort of took a break from football between sort of 16 to 18. And I wasn't playing on Saturdays or Sundays. And I didn't think football. I'd failed a couple of trials. Well, I'd gone along. I'd done okay, Sam, but didn't quite have enough. I hadn't physically developed enough to be as strong as I was by the time I got 19, 20. And from nowhere, I got offered an opportunity to play for a team in Kent League, which they asked me to play as a centre-half. And from there, very quickly, I established myself. And then one particular game, era from Belvedere away in the Kent League, our centre-forward had a bad injury and I got asked to play up front because the manager, who I'm still friends with today, Steve Wishart, said to me, can you play up front? I heard you played there as a kid and done really well. Would you play? Played that game, scored a hat-trick and the rest was really history, Sam.
It's interesting because I know that that ground, Erith and Belvedere, it's a B&Q now.
Yes, like many teams at lower levels, they've all been transformed into other things.
And you were transformed into something completely different. You became a number nine. When you hear that phrase, the number nine, what does it mean for you? What's the sort of definition of a number nine?
I think it's obvious. It's a pivotal position. So many iconic players in the game have been number nines. I never really was a true number nine until I got to the latter stages of my career. But when I got to Gillingham, I was very raw. My first training game was actually against Steve Bruce, who was a centre-half for Gillingham. And we had a trial match and Gillingham were watching me to see how I did and I'd done really well. I had one particular header. I just headed over the bar but put Steve Bruce on his backside with the header with the power I got behind it. And Keith Peacock, who was the manager, said to me, I'll give you a year's contract. Oh, we'll see how it goes. And that was it, Sam. I sort of started from there.
Did you ever fight over getting the number nine jersey? Did that ever matter to you?
No, and that was a problem, Sam, because as I got further along in my career, there were so many selfish, brilliant number nines.
And it comes to Allen! And what a superb finish! Dixon charging through, there's a chance here for Dixon, oh, brilliant play by Dixon, he scored!
Stapleton again, Olsen's in a bit of space on the far side, a deflection, and a goal!
They were so selfish in the way they fought, but for the benefit of the team, Sam, not, you know, they saw the whites of the post, they would score, and when they did see someone like Teddy would see things that he could lay you in, set you up, they were just brilliant at doing what they did, and I wasn't, I was too selfless as a number nine. I didn't have the courage or the desire to be a ultimate predator, which I got later in my career, but I did think it held me back as a striker. And my goals tally, although that if I look back and the numbers were good, it should have been far higher because I tended to be more of a leader of the line, not really think about goals as often as, but the importance of being a goal scorer. You know, I grew up watching John Toshack, Bob Latchford, Joe Royal, you know, just to name a few, great headers of the ball and great leaders of the line, but all got goals as well. And I didn't really have that same desire to get goals, which I certainly did later on.
Why was that, do you think? It was just you didn't have that personality. You weren't that sort of character that lived and breathed for the goal.
No, I think John Aldridge played a big part in that, although I never really spoke to John Aldridge about it, is that John, and he wouldn't forgive me for saying this, he wasn't the quickest, he wasn't the greatest in the air, he wasn't the greatest technically, but he would get goals in, goals out.
Oh, a goal for Aldridge! Right on half-time, it's John Aldridge.
He played for Liverpool Football Club. You know, internationally, he could get goals. He scored goals in Spain when he went to Real Sociedad. And I could never work out why we'd play five-a-sides in training and John might not play particularly well but walk off with four goals for his team. And I realised that John had an incredible, canny way of playing. He took the minimalist amount of touches. I mean, one touch when it was on to score. He would very rarely control it. He would always try and do things immediately. And a lot of the strikers that I played with, Clive Allen definitely, I think Teddy would take a touch if he needed it at times. And just Kerry Dixon, it first time. You know, he just saw the opportunity to hit it, he would. And John was the bit of a turning point in my career because I did realise, Sam, that why did he keep getting so many goals? Why did he get goals in training? Why did he shank things that you think was far easier to score? But he's never, ever lost the ability to get goals, John.
Would you believe it? Cascarino, can he finish? No, he can't.
The top strikers that I've spoken to over the course of this series have always shirked the idea of missing. It don't matter to miss. Missing is not important to them. They would miss 10 chances. Who cares about the misses? They knew that another chance would come and that they would bury it. You didn't have that, did you?
No, Sam. I think in my early part of my career, I got scarred by missing. You could some way describe that a golfer can get the yips in front of, you know, in front of the hole from 3 foot, 5 foot. I think I was a period in my career that I was so affected mentally by chances that I missed in the game. Instead of, like you say, you just eradicate it. You carry on, you wait for the next one, you try and take that one. And that's something that took a long process for me. I got affected by reaction. When I first played, when I was at Gillingham, I was so raw, so naive. And yet it was one of my strengths. But that went away. The more established and the more experienced I became by my mid-20s, I hadn't... That had all, you know, that rawness of me had gone. And now I was affected by what player I should be and how much of an impact I would have on my team. So it changed as I went along.
OK, let's get a few quickfire questions from you to get a sense of who Tony Cascarino is. What was your favourite goal?
Internationally, I would definitely go against England.
Stotton. Cascarino up.
Graham Taylor was the England manager and he'd signed me for Villa the previous year. And Sam, it was really weird because I joined. And when I joined Aston Villa, I'm in Doug Ellis's house and I'm talking to Graham Taylor. And I asked him, if I come, will you still be the Villa manager? Because there was rumours of him getting the England job. And he said, no, I'll be Villa manager. And then 8 to 10 weeks later, he took the England job. So when I was getting warmed up to go on and England were winning 1-0, he basically gave me the look of, don't you dare, you know, and I went on and scored a header past Wood in goal. Was a big moment for me. And I know that Graham Taylor was probably swearing. You know that famous scene of him swearing at linesman about costing me his job? I'm pretty sure he's swearing at his assistants and staff saying, he couldn't bloody get a goal for Aston Villa when I was manager. You know, so that was a big goal for me. Club-wise, strangely enough, Sam, I would say a friendly against Juventus for Marseille. I scored 2 goals and they put their first 11 out. And there was a big crowd in Marseille. And I was playing against a guy called Kohler, who was the German centre-half. And I played against him about 6 months before. and I was probably about 6-8 pounds heavier than I was that night. And he said to me after the game and shook my hand, he said, "You are not the same player as you was 6 months ago." I really give him a hard time. And it realised that I'd become a proper centre-forward by that time. Even though it was a friendly, and people might go, how can you say a friendly? That them two goals against Juve meant a hell of a lot to me as about where I'd, how far I'd come as a footballer.
Who was your favourite strike partner?
Definitely Teddy, without a doubt.
And the ball breaks in Sheringham with a great reaction. That's 1-1.
If you wanted a perfect foil, and if you look at Sheringham and go, look how many partnerships he had across his career, whether it's Klinsmann at Tottenham, whether it's Ferdinand Shearer with England, and many more, Robbie Keane, Jurgen Klinsmann. They just, honestly, his list of partners is extraordinary. And I think if you asked every one of us who played alongside him who was their favourite partner, I think probably nearly all of us would name Teddy.
Who was your childhood hero?
Well, Kevin Keegan originally, but as I become a team, because Kevin Keegan was the, being a Liverpool fan, Kevin Keegan and Tosh at the partnership, and I love Keegan, his work ethic, and just, you know, wasn't the most gifted, but made absolutely maximum out of his ability. But then obviously he went to Germany, and Dalglish was my ultimate hero because of what Kenny was. The things that Kevin Keegan didn't have, Kenny had, raw natural ability. And I sort of a mix between the two, but probably King Kenny as my ultimate hero.
Which manager got the best out of you?
Well, Keith Peacock started with me at Gillingham, and I had a bad injury at Gillingham, which kept me sort of out of the game for about 6 months. He was very understanding of my development. But if I took it on, I'd then go to John Doherty. That when I joined Millwall, he said to me, "Do you like a drink?" This is his first meeting, Sam, in his office, and I said, "Well, I'm okay." And he went, "You know, you need to be fit to drink." And I went, "Oh, what do you mean?" And he went, "Well, if you do like a drink, you need to be really fit to play for me." Well, I've got to say, after his training session, Sam, I knew exactly what he meant. He would always call me, Terry Hurlock, and the goalkeeper, Brian Horn, "Come on, you three, we're doing extra training." After every training session, or say everyone, but any day like Tuesday before, you know, before the Saturday game, we had time to recover. But he'd always work as hard Tuesday and Wednesdays, all three of us. And he just went for me, knowing that I had to be in peak condition. He argued with, he'd say, "When you're a big centre forward, if you're slightly out of condition, you can look awkward, ungamely, and you could, if you're not quite on the edge of your performance, you'll look cumbersome as a striker." And he was so right with me.
I got my mind set on you.
Hooked it away by Harford. Oh, that's a goal! A great shot from Tony Cascarino.
He's too favouring the half volley, and he finds Sheringham. Herlock, Cascarino, yes.
It's going to take plenty of money to do it right, child.
Some strikers are goal machines, some set themselves targets. One former England striker we used to work with, Stan Collymore, used to say, 20 league goals a season, that's the mark of excellence. And it's what you should strive for every season. Did you set yourself a minimum target?
No. Like I said earlier, Sam, that was probably one of my faults. I did that. It got very competitive with Teddy Sheringham at Millwall, because Teddy was the first person to make me feel like I was in a competition. And I took it slightly the wrong way initially, but I realised Teddy was doing it to get the best out of you. You know, he was younger than me. I came as a £200,000 striker from Gillingham to Millwall with 3 years probably more experience, and yet Teddy felt more experienced. And he loved competition. If you play him at golf, or you play him in others, anything else, if you had swimming, you know, you're on holiday and you're in a swimming race, he'd want to beat you. And I think he tried to make it competitive to get the best out of me. And that is another thing that I learnt along the way.
And Millwall was great for you, wasn't it? Promotion to the top flight, working alongside Teddy, 42 league goals in 105 games. Did it click because of your relationship ostensibly with him?
Yes, I'd watched Millwall the previous season when I was at Gillingham. My contract was coming to an end, and I watched Millwall a few times, and I saw Teddy play. He was alongside a lad called Michael Marks, and I just kept thinking he's so easy to play alongside because his movement and positions he took up in the pitch. When I first started, Sam, at Gillingham, I played up front alongside a guy that very few listeners will know called Mark Weatherly. And he was very similar to Ted. He wasn't the quickest, great ball control, really difficult to play against, leader of the line, playing little pockets. And I was allowed to run the channels and get in behind and the spaces that were there because I was a lot quicker than Mark and Teddy. And that was why I felt I could play with Teddy as a forward. And look, it's easy in hindsight because we'd of course say we're being smart. But it was just a joy to know that Teddy always wanted the ball. And he'd always, do you know one thing that stood out for me as well, Sam, as well? The talking of play. Ray Houghton was a great talker in the, on the pitch. And sometimes annoyingly, it'd drive you crazy. Just keep talk. Teddy was the same. Teddy would talk a lot when you were playing.
He hasn't changed, by the way.
No, I know he hasn't.
Ray's still the same in the commentary box.
Yeah, well, that's why you're doing great commentary, Sam, with him, because Ray's never short of a word. And Teddy never was on the pitch either. You always knew where Teddy was. You always knew how he wanted it. And even if he was having a bad game, Teddy was going to have a stinker because he never stopped wanting that ball. And talking was... And again, that become another thing that I added, another string to my bow as I become a more experienced player, is that how you talked and what you said when you were playing. And I think it's another asset that I think I got in my latter stages of my career.
What was the club like to play for in those days? What was the atmosphere around Cold Blow Lane? Because it was obviously a very different club to what it's like now.
Feisty, Sam. I think, it's raw. Obviously on the terraces, the fans would be pretty outspoken if you had a bad time. I can remember coming up out in one of my first games for Millwall. I heard a Millwall fan as you run through the tunnel onto the pitch shout out, "Sheringham, get that piano off your back." And I was thinking, wow, that's a young lad he's shouting that at too. You know, he's just on the start of his career. And Cheddy's laughed about that since, you know. And I remember Millwall fan giving me the donkey noise as I was, you know, literally 3-4 games in. And there was no breathing space. There was no, he's just joined the club, see how he goes. It was immediate. And so you knew what you were going to get if you was a Millwall player at that time. As much as Millwall fans could be fantastic, if you weren't playing well, Sam, it weren't going to be easy for you.
We come from the same sort of area, North Kent, South East London. Growing up in the 90s, you were sort of an ever-present in the local papers, in the national papers, on TV. Everyone in our area talked about you, the Millwall star who goes to Villa, goes to Celtic, ends up at Chelsea. Did you enjoy all the attention that brought?
Yes, I did enjoy it, Sam, but it's like all things. If you're playing well and game's easy for you and you're doing things on quite a laid-back approach and everything's rosy, it's great. If it's not, which I experienced in other moves in my... You know, you're a Chelsea fan, Sam, and you know that there was a time when I got a bit of stick. I can remember one of my funny experiences being a centre-forward and being on the bench and there was this guy behind the dugout near the tunnel and every time I got up, Sam, he would just go, "Oh, no, sit down! Not you, except that." And I would be like, I remember thinking, please, man, like Ian Portfield, who was the manager, please don't ask me to get warmed up. This guy behind me is going to just jump on me. And he did it every time. And then one day I cracked Sam. I just turned around and said to him, "Look, we'll have a word afterwards, after the match." And you know what? It wasn't in a way that we're sorting out with our fists or anything like that. I actually chatted to him and I said, "Look, I know you're giving me stick, mate. You're not doing me any favour." And he was actually all right guy. And he laughed at me and said, "Look, I'm doing it because you're not my favourite player. I'll be up front with you, but you are a trier, son, and I'll give you that." And it was like, from that moment onwards, I didn't have this fan going to me every time I warmed up. Sit down, Cascarino. No, Portfield, what are you doing? You know, honestly. But funny times.
I did have to tell Dad not to go after that.
Yeah, I know, Sam. But football's great. It's like all things. When you're winning and everything's going along spiffingly and you're playing well, it's everything's easy. The moment you're tested, and I got tested at Celtic, I got tested at Chelsea. Villa was a little bit strange, but I loved it at Villa. That period of a year and a bit at Villa, I really enjoyed it. It was just a massive transition from Graham Taylor leaving that football club, who I think would have got the best out of me because Graham, like John Doherty at Millwall, his training sessions would have suited me because they were very tough and I needed my backside whipped regularly, Sam. That's what got the best out of me.
And he was direct, wasn't he? I mean, you know, let's not make any bones about it. Graham would play direct and that would suit you, would it?
Well, of course it would, Sam. Look at me with the Republic of Ireland. It suited me. You know, we had a team of very talented footballers, yet we got things early. I had Dennis Irwin on one side, I had Steve Staunton on the other, Chrissy Morris. You know, we had players who could deliver great balls, Kevin Sheedy, Ray Houghton. So I wanted the ball in certain areas of the pitch. I wanted to be at the far post. I wanted to try and get on fullbacks, nod things back into a danger area, or if not, go directly at goal, lead the line. And when I first made my debut for Republic of Ireland, Sam, I roomed with Frank Stapleton. And now, when you go, you play for Arsenal and you play for Manchester United, that's a top player. That's a Van Persie. You know, when you play for Arsenal and then Man United. So imagine for me in League One, which it is now, sitting my debut for Ireland against Switzerland, and I'm rooming with Frank Stapleton. You know, so this is the quality I was looking at.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's sort of, you know, you look back at a career and you can pick the bits out of it that you think should have been better or you could have done better. But ultimately, when you're in it at the time, it's incredibly different, isn't it? I mean, and that whole sort of like sliding doors moment of Josef Venglos, I think it was, who came in after Graham Taylor. And Graham Taylor going off to England may well have changed the entire course of your career, really. Do you sort of... I know when we talk to managers about taking their first steps into the profession, they always say, pick your chairman, pick the best chairman you can find. For a centre-forward or for any player... Is it about making sure you pick the manager that is going to get the best out of you?
Yes, I think all the best managers I've played under have really wanted me as well, which is important, Sam, because if I fast forward slightly, you mentioned Graham Taylor, Josef Venglos, and after Josef Venglos lost his job, Ron Atkinson got the job. And the first day of being there, Ron said to me, you can go. And so obviously I wasn't Ron Atkinson's, the first meeting, and I've spoke to Ron, you know, years down the line. His first conversation with me is said, I've agreed a fee with Celtic, Southampton are interested as well. Would you go? You can go. You're not going to be, I'm bringing in Big Cyril. And that was it. And in some ways I'm like, well, that's fair enough. He's been blunt and upfront with me. That's how it works. I'll take that. But you've got to be wanted. You've got to understand, you know, having a manager understands your qualities and trying to get the best out of your qualities is a big thing for a centre forward. You know, I watched the early days of Didier Drogba at Chelsea.
Here is Ivanovic into the area, works his way away from James, pulls the ball back. Here's Didier Drogba!
He wasn't a certain starter from day one. He really had to fight with his, you know, prestige at the club and for fans to love him to a level of what they did at the very end. You know, it took him quite a long time to get that. But the manager always stood by him, didn't he, Josie, for that period of time?
Yeah, and that was really important for him.
Yeah.
You went to Celtic then. They came in for you. As someone who was playing for Ireland, I suppose that was quite a special moment, really. Did you think that after the situation with Villa, where it didn't work out the way you wanted it to, right, this is a restart, I can reset?
Yes, and I let my heart rule my head, really, with Celtic, because it was the dream of the Irish number nine going to play for the Hoops and going to Parkhead and the history of the football club. Unfortunately, the dynamics at Celtic were very different. Liam Brady was a friend and obviously became the manager of Celtic. But there was a lot of underlining problems at the club. Obviously, Rangers were dominating Scottish football at that time. And there was a real inferior complex within the dressing room. I wasn't at my best physically. I was sort of recovering from an injury that I tried to play through. Didn't play well, Sam. It's probably the poorest run of games that I ever had at a club. You know, my performances at Celtic, I think I'd have booed myself, Sam. You know, it was that bad, how poorly I was playing. I didn't seem to... And it goes back to my condition. I was probably playing a 14 stone 8 at Celtic, and I was always under 14 stone. And I noticed it. I just didn't feel right. And when you're not feeling right and your head's affected mentally and you're struggling, put all that into a cocktail, you are going to have a poor game. You're going to play regularly, not very well. And I didn't. I just never really got going. I mean, I scored in the Old Firm derby against Rangers at Ibrox.
Backman with the pass back to Cascarino, and equaliser. Break from the midfield though by Joe Milner. Lovely pass away to that far side to Tommy Coyne. Cascarino's through the centre. Can Coyne find him? Does find him. Oh, the ball just gets beyond Henry Smith, and that is Tony Cascarino's first ever goal in the green and white hoops.
I scored against Hearts. I came on as sub a few times and scored goals, but I just never, ever played. The unfortunate thing for me is Celtic fans will see me as probably one of the worst players that ever played for their team. Well, if you judge me on what they saw, you'd agree with it, but I think they just never saw me at my very best.
You wrote in your best-selling autobiography, The Secret Life of Tony Cascarino, which is one of the seminal football books of the generation, I think. So many different stories about how your personal life sort of intertwined with your football life. Did it ever interfere and cause you a distraction?
Yeah, it did. I mean, when I was at Celtic, me and Sarah, my first wife, were having a bit of a difficult time. I moved to Scotland, so it's all changed for her. She's a South London girl. I wasn't playing. One particular day, her mum come up, Sam, and went and played a game and didn't play well, come home, got sick. Me and Sarah were having an argument, and Sarah's mum turned around and said to me, "Don't ever go at my Sarah because you're playing rubbish." And it was quite weird for mother-in-law to tell me, that. So, it was an issue. And then, obviously, when I went to Marseille, I actually played really well, but I'd split up from Sarah at that time. And it's weird. But, yes, I think, if I'm brutally honest, you need a very strong woman behind you, like in many things in life, and things have to work. Me and Sarah there was too many issues off the field that had gone on, and I was mostly to blame for that. But it's that balance of I think that Sir Alex Ferguson talked about it. He wanted his players to be really sorted in their life and have their feet on the ground as a player, in their marriage, in their everything around their life, to try and be perfect for them to be the best footballer. I never really had that all the time.
Still to come on Up Front with Tony Cascarino, he discusses how he bowed out of his international career in some style.
He's jumped up and literally threw one on me, Sam, full on. I didn't expect it, but from there, it just went into carnage.
You're listening to Up Front with Tony Cascarino on TalkSport.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. There's a lot more to those 90 minutes than what goes down on the pitch. With the latest odds, form guides and expert opinions, you'll know the score with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org. T's and C's apply.
Staunton. Scarino up. Oh, it's there! Towards Staunton. There's no offside. Staunton delivers the cross. Burn there!
Strikers are the kingpins, the man or woman who takes the adulation when the ball hits the net. They score the goals, they're on the back pages, they generate the headlines. There is another side to it as well, and there's a poignant moment in your book where you talk about the voices in your head, the overthinking that goes on, that ultimately, I think you believe, prevented you taking more chances. The cross would come in and there'd be something in your brain saying to you, "You're going to miss this, you're going to miss this."
Yeah. And
do you know how debilitating that was?
Well, it was a lot more easy to understand after I'd finished playing, because I spoke about it in my book. And I can remember speaking to Sonia Sullivan, the great Irish runner, and she turned around and said to me, "I had a real problem in my head when I took the lead in a race. I would think that I would fall apart once I took the lead. And I was like, wow, this happens to a top athlete. That's how I felt sometimes in games. There was a period in my career where I was not wanting the cross to come in on my right foot because it wasn't my greatest side. I didn't feel confident of getting a clean strike on the ball to score. And yeah, and I said earlier, Sam, there was a period in my career I can only describe as having the yips in my game. And that was in front of goal, which is, as a centre forward, that's a pretty serious problem. You know, and of course, crowd get on your back and I don't convert a chance that they might seem quite comfortable or have to be a professional sportsman. You should be able to bury them quite clearly. There was a game at Chelsea where a team were playing. We had a free kick out on the right, Sam, and the ball was played in and they all pushed up. And I managed to make a run and I found myself on the penalty spot all on my own and everyone had run out of the team we were playing. So left me literally on my own, it just the keeper in front of me. And I just headed it into his arms. Well, Sam, the reaction from the crowd was at Stamford Bridge was extraordinary. If they could have strangled me and run on the pitch, it was just... I remember that moment, that decision of as I'm waiting for that ball to come on me, I had an eternity to go, take it on my chest, try and place it, and I chose to try and head it first time and literally head it into his arms. It was like as if I was a defender for the opposition who just said, here, keeper, have it back. And at that moment,
And what was going through your mind?
Just that I knew I was on my own and it was a really split second decision. Instead of thinking, right, how do I deal with this? Do I take it down, which I had plenty of time to do? I took the easy option, was to try and head it first time with just a nothing header. And I remember thinking the negative of not having the thinking, you know, in my later period of my career, I remember thinking, right, I've got time. Get it on your chest, get it under control and bury it. But I didn't, at that time, I just didn't think like that. I thought, just meet the ball and head it, which wasn't the option.
Around this time, you were still featuring for Ireland regularly. I mean, you had a brilliant Ireland career. 14 international years with a side that were qualifying for all sorts of tournaments that no one ever thought that they would be able to do. 88 games, loads of goals. When the phone first rang, what did you think?
Well, I never got a call because it always come via the manager. Keith Peacock, who's the manager at Gillingham, had told me that I'd been called up for an international friendly against Spurs in a testimonial. And would I be interested? Because we had a goalkeeper called Seamus McDonough, a lot of fans would remember, who was part of the sort of Irish setup in particular times under Martin O'Neill. And he asked me about my Irish ancestry and I'd said that I had an Irish mum, blah blah blah, and so I got called up. Keith Peacock told me and I went and played in a game, played really well against Steve Wicks, who was the centre half that day. Terry Venables was managing the opposition, played well, and then got called up for my first World Cup qualifier against Switzerland away in the final stages of a group stage, which we didn't actually qualify for the World Cup, but we got games in and I started my career with Republic of Ireland. It was just a roller coaster ride for me and many ups and downs because I had a bad injury that I didn't play for Ireland between Owen Hand losing his job and Jack Charlton getting the manager's job.
Jack produced a great side of players who were, well, they were from everywhere really, weren't they? I mean, Townsend, Houghton, yeah. Aldridge, McCarthy, none of them born in Ireland, but did you all feel Irish? Did were you made to feel Irish?
Yes. Never one player that I can remember, and even the players you mentioned have never said this, we were never felt unwelcome in Ireland. There was no grievance with us representing Ireland. It was just extraordinary. Jack decided to use as many rules as he could to get players in that he felt were eligible and capable and produced a really good side. And he also had a number of very good players who were born in Ireland. So the mix between the two of us was harmony. As you know, Sam, you know a lot of players who played in that squad will all tell you we got on incredibly well. Huge amount of characters. Yes, we did things and went a bit too far with the drinking at times, but it was never, ever, we never left anything off that football field. There was many games I played in. I just, the character of the team and the drive, desire to be a good side. And Jack was fortunate. He had a lot of us at the right age, which he obviously didn't by the time his Ireland manager's job was come into question where he wasn't the manager by the time 96 come. He had an extraordinary group of squad of players, some very, very good ones in there.
90, 92, 94, all great tournaments. What was your favourite one?
90, Italia 90, because I had a great qualifying campaign, scoring a good few goals, playing well, leading the line, number one choice. Going to Italy, well, obviously, my Italian background, it was just a joy. It was quite weird, Sam. We played Italy in the last eight, in the quarterfinals, and I was leading the line, obviously, before the tournament started, and Viali was leading their line, and me and him were both subs. And I remember looking across to him, and I exchanged shirts with Viali after the game. And I remember thinking, he was the number one starter, and Scalacci came about. He'd found himself being left out. I was a certain start with Ireland, found myself left out and on the bench. And people, you know, managers sometimes say, Premier League football, you have five, six in really indifferent games, you can be left out. International football, Sam, you can have two and be left out. You know, I went through England, which we drew 1-1, Egypt 0-0. I was left out after that. After two games into a World Cup, Jack had decided to make a change.
You were massive in Ireland, and so was everybody else in that squad and those squads over that period of time. But you eventually realised that you weren't actually eligible to play for Ireland. Mm. How did you find out?
Yeah, I was on international duty. We were in Luxembourg, and I'd played about 66 times for Ireland, and we were told by the next home game we would have to produce all the documentation for representing Ireland and for our passports, because we all had to play off an Irish passport. So for me to get an Irish passport, I had to get certain certificates, you know, my mum's birth certificate. And I go to St Catherine's House in London, get my mum's certificate, and on the certificate, she thought was her mum and dad, wasn't. It was another name. And that's when the ball started rolling of, you know, my mum was actually adopted. She had a sister that was, well, I say a sister, was actually her mum. It gets confusing, Sam. Lots of people get confused. I even get confused telling this story sometimes. But she had a sister that was 20 years older than her, which she thought was her mum and dad, that now became her grandparents, because she was the daughter of what she thought was her sister. So that's how it all came about. So it was a massive challenge within the family, because my mum had to come to terms with that the woman that she thought was her sister for all these years wasn't actually her sister, was her mum. And that was weird for my mum to deal with. So it was a personal issue more overriding, really, me representing Ireland and under the adoption laws. And when I spoke about it in the book, Sam, I tried to tell it in the stories how I felt at the time. I felt I was a fraud and I felt I was a fake but playing for Ireland. But obviously after we went through all the rules and I was eligible to play under the adoption laws. So my mum being adopted, my mum's called Teresa O'Malley, Sam. I mean, if you make it up, I mean, you couldn't get a more Irish name, could you?
Your international career ended with a 4-match ban, a blood all over your chest and face, a scrap, and a failure to reach Euro 2000. Now, that was a proper way to go out, wasn't it? What happened?
Yeah, we played Turkey, and it wasn't a nice... The first game in Dublin wasn't particularly great. We go there, it was 0-0. We needed to get a goal to win the game and qualify. And there was a few things that happened. There was a couple of spitting incidents with a central defender who spat at me a couple of times. And I thought, this was all in my head as the game's going on, by the way. If we go out, I'm going to make sure that I'm going to let this centre-half know. And I'd done a really quite a timid thing. As the game ended and they'd qualified, that he went to run off and I flicked his foot. So he tripped and sort of stumbled and nearly fell over. He's jumped up and then literally threw one on me, Sam, full on. I didn't expect it, but from there, it just went into carnage, free for all. And I'm taking punches, trying to throw. And there was fans on the pitch, there was players. And this was all in the space of a minute, 2 minutes max. And from a celebration, it turned into a free-for-all on the football field. And I got a few truncheons on the head as I was going past the police in the tunnel going to the dressing room. It was all happening, Sam. And I've still got that ban today. So even if they called me up, I can't play.
Quella bianconera, esce Rampulla. Attenzione, De Wolf, Cascarino e la rete. La rete per Olympique Marsiglia, ma grande passo.
pouvoir centrer.
After Chelsea, where it wasn't going as well as you'd hoped, and you've already outlined that, you've got the fabulous opportunity to go to France, and not just any club in France, but the famous Marseille. Now, circumstances had changed there, but what went through your mind when that offer came?
Well, I was away in World Cup duty in 94. Glenn spoke to me just prior to my final game in England, which was the FA Cup final, which you'll remember, well, Sam, losing 4-0 to Manchester United.
cried that day.
Yeah, and as we were doing the... we still did the open top bus around Stamford Bridge after the game, and Glenn pulled me to one side and said, I'm keeping Nigel Spackman. I'm going to let you go. And then I sort of went to the World Cup and thought, I'd take my chances. I could have signed for Cheltenham. I'd said I wanted to wait to after the tournament to make my decision. Went to America, started training, got injured with a thunderstorm, Sam, and we went from the because of the dangers of out on the pitch training with thunder and lightning going on. We went inside to a gym. I did the stepmaster, and I felt my calf afterwards. Trained the next day, pulled my calf muscle, and now I'm out of the team really for a 2 or 3 week period. Saw a faith healer in America trying to get my, you know, I was trying anything to try and get fit, Sam. So, but in that period, I had a number of faxes because that was coming through. Blackpool were interested. John Sheridan, who played for Sheffield Wednesday in Ireland, he laughed and said, well, don't rule that out. There's a great big dipper ride in Blackpool, which, you know, great fun at the time. Mike Walker, who's the manager, I thought, of Everton. It was Mick Walker at Notts County was interested in speaking to me. So there were sort of two funny scenarios that developed. But I got the last laugh, Sam, because I got a fax through from Marseille and an agent, Dennis Roth, who you'd know. He said to me, Marseille are interested. And I showed this to a few of the boys and they were like, what, the European champions? No chance. They didn't know the circumstances around Marseille. So they were all laughing. Yeah, all right, you're going Marseille. But obviously I found out the details that they'd been relegated and there was a huge change at the football club. And I remember going into the office for the first time to agree to sign for Marseille. And as I was walking into the office, Sam, Rudi Völler was walking out, who's the centre forward, the German international many people had known. He was walking out and said to me, good luck, Tony, and your time, you'll love Marseille. And it was really weird that this guy that had won, you know, so much in his career, he was off from Marseille. But it was literally a blanket sale. You know, everyone was leaving, Sam. You know, all the top earners, they had to change. They could only bring in players for free transfers, and I was on a free. Bernard Tapie wanted an international. So that's how it all came about.
From the minute you arrived there, did you think to yourself, this is going to work? And why was it that you were so successful there? What was different about it? Because I suppose it was a different sort of football playing in Ligue 2, as it is.
Yeah, well, I was vulnerable in the dressing room. It was the first time I'd ever been taken out of the safety net of a dressing room, Sam, where you got your mates and you're all, you know, you're doing the things after game. You might nip out with the boys and you're one of the lads. Now I was vulnerable in a dressing room. I didn't really have, there was no clique I was involved in. I was just quiet. All I had was concentrate on football. And do you know what, Sam? It was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because now all I can do is train and work hard and get myself in the best shape I can. And when the first game of the season came around, we got a penalty in the first half. I literally ran and grabbed the ball. I wanted to show that I immediately that this was my intent. So I grabbed the ball, scored with a penalty, and then it just snowballed. I got fitter, Sam. I played at Marseille. I talked about earlier in the show, I said to you, I played at Celtic at 14 stone 8. At Marseille, I was as low as 13 stone 6. Now, it was the first time in my career I really knew I was a good athlete because I could run and run and run at 13 stone 6. And as much as I'd like to paint it any other way, the problem with football in the 80s and certainly the early 90s in England was that so many of us were ill-disciplined off the field. We hadn't had the influx of foreign players coming to our game and teaching us, you know, the great habits of just your diet. We lived in a pub culture, most of the teams I played for. If you listen to any players, Ray Parlour will tell you stories and many other players. Ray will tell you, Ray Houghton tell you stories about the way we lived our life. I wasn't a player that could abuse myself. I couldn't get away with it, Sam. I had to be really serious about my profession, be dedicated, and that's what I did at Marseille. And I ended up playing, I think I'm the longest serving player to play in France than anybody else. I lasted nearly 7 years of playing football in France.
You're talking from an English point of view, the yes. longest serving Englishman in France.
Yeah, I don't, Irishman. You know, I set a few records out there. I'm talking an Englishman, well, I'm not an Englishman, an Irishman playing in a foreign country. I don't think anybody, no, John Collins played a few years there, Chrissy Waddle, Glenn Hoddle, Mark Haley. I was best part of 7 years in France playing football, which no one else did. I got the oldest hat-trick player in France of 37 years. And
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, you know, still second to El Ted and I.
That was at Nancy, wasn't it? Because you went on to Nancy after you'd finished at Marseille.
Yeah.
And you scored that hat-trick at 37 years of age in Ligue 1. So this is in the top flight in France. And again, the manager sort of devised a system that gave you a new lease of life.
Yeah, well, let me give you a little bit of background about Laszlo Bolony, who was a Romanian who won the Champions League for Starbucker Rest in 86 against the famous Barcelona. Got a draw, won on penalties. When I joined the club, I joined Nancy at nearly 34, Sam. I was 33, nearly about 33 and a half. And when I joined, he said to me, how long's your contract? And I said, 2 years. And he said, you'll play for 4 years under me. And I looked at him thinking, really? I'm nearly 34. Again, going back to the John Doherty scenario, he trained me like you wouldn't believe, Sam. It's the hardest training I'd ever done in my career. And he argued that this comfort zone of senior players, when they get to their latter years, they take the foot off the pedal. His idea was a complete contradiction because he said to me, you have to train harder than them just to keep up with them, the younger players. And when I first started playing, he said to me, I want you to play as my lone striker. And I was thinking, really? 33, nearly 34. You want me to be a... I'm dreading it. I'm thinking, no way. And he said to me, I'm going to give you the quickest two wide men you'll ever play with, that you will just lead the line, you'll feed things on, and we'll get players running behind you. We have a great midfielder as well who can get beyond the midfielder and into the areas behind the back four. And I never felt I'd enjoy it, Sam, because I've always said to everybody who's been a centre-forward, you'll never, ever like playing on your own. Every centre-forward I've ever known wants to have a partner. Partners are important to you to make you do things, get the best out of you, create chances. You need to get goals for them as well. And I found I really enjoyed the role. I never thought I would, Sam. I was dreading this role of being on my own up front. And yet, I learned a lot about my game in that period of time under Laszlo Bolony at Nancy.
And the perfect hat-trick is our little quiz right at the end of these interviews that we were doing with our number nines to see how well you know yourself. I think you'll remember quite a lot about your career, but maybe that's the gambler in me. Okay, so we've got three questions for you. Gillingham bought you from Crokenhill, effectively,
yeah,
sort of. How did they pay the transfer fee?
Well, track suits and cones and just equipment, Sam. I mean, it's been exaggerated, that story. We know that most stories are exaggerated, but that really is. But it was done. Why it happened, Sam, was because I wasn't under contract with Crokenhill and Gillingham didn't have to pay a fee. So as a gesture, they gave Crokenhill, which was much needed at Kent level, equipment, tracksuits, balls. So that's how it all come from.
1993-94, your last game for Chelsea was where?
Well, it was the FA Cup final against Manchester United at Wembley.
It was, indeed. Your Ireland career ended in which Turkish city? We talked about the scrap, but where was it?
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Was it in Izmir?
I've caught him out.
Was it Izmir?
Bursa.
Oh, Bursa, yes. Oh, do you know, Sam, that journey in Bursa, yep. we flew, considering it was a playoff game and the return leg of this playoff game, we flew to Turkey, Istanbul, then we got on a boat and then we got on a bus. And the whole journey took, imagine that we're planning quite short spaces of time. It took us something like 14 hours to get to Bursa.
No wonder you wanted to scrap afterwards.
Yes.
Listen, Thank you very much. It's been great to talk to you and great to look back at your wonderful career, your eventful career. Yeah. It's always great to look back. I mean, before we'd even started talking properly, I'd read the book and I was amazed by that. But to sit and talk to you about it has been great. So thank you very much for your time. Tony Cascarino.
Cheers, Sam. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Upfront with Tony Cascarino and me, Sam Matterface. And if you missed any of the show or want to catch up, you can listen back to the podcast from the Game Day feed, available on the free TalkSport app.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. The latest odds? We set them. Form guides? We've got them. Expert opinions? We share them. The best fans in the world deserve the best. Be match day ready before the whistle blows with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org. T's and C's apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.